Okay, so I wanted to, this is going to fall off, I'm not used to this. I wanted to tell you about some problems that I've been interested in over the last year and a half or so, all of which, in one form or the other, can be traced back to browsings and readings of this massive tome, whose centenary, I think, is going to be celebrated in 2012. So, D'Arcy Thompson was a mathematician, a naturalist, a Greek scholar, a Latin scholar, and he wrote the first edition of this book in on growth and form in 1912, and the last edition was 1942. In which he says, in the preface, how far even then mathematics would suffice to describe and physics to explain the fabric of the body, no man can foresee. And then he goes on to say, cell and tissue, shell and bone, leaf and flower are so many portions of matter, and it is in obedience to the laws of physics and their particles that the particles have been moved, molded, or conformed. There are no exceptions to the rule that God always geometrizes, I suppose, quoting Plato. Their problems of form are in the first instance mathematical problems, their problems of growth are essentially physical problems, and the morphologist is ipso facto a student of physical science. So I'd like to tell you about a few questions which are somehow motivated by that book, on three different scales and using three different examples. One, which I'm going to start out with, is how does a pollen tube grow? So pollen tube is a tube that essentially comes out from a pollen grain and then finds its way to the ovule, starts the process of fertilization, which then gives rise to seeds, fruits, the new gametes that actually you see in plants. That pollen grain over there is of the order of about 50 to 100 microns. They can be as small as 10 microns, they can be quite large, a fraction of a millimeter. And that's work done with the postdoctoral fellow, O.J. Kampas. The second third of the talk, I want to talk about leaves. In fact, there was a very nice set of lettuce leaves on which you had your fruits, and I should have pulled one in, but I forgot. And you see that leaves, in fact, often have interesting shapes. And Darwin said something rather wonderful. He said that plant morphology is so complex, and the patterns and the diversity that you see are so many that it's enough to make the sanest man mad. So one of the questions that one would like to ask is, are there simple principles that nevertheless give rise to tremendous complexity in shape? And those simple principles are associated with growth or differential growth. And then finally, I initially was planning, at least according to the abstract that I read just now, I was planning to talk about how the gut coils, but instead I'm going to talk about how the brain folds. But I'm actually talking about one very simple aspect of the brain and how the brain folds. And I'm going to talk about how these very spectacular looking creases, which are extremely reproducible on the large scale from one brain to the other, but not on the small scale, how they might form. And I'm going to use a very, very characteristic experiment, a macroscopic experiment to show you how that forms. And that's the thesis, actually, of Evan Holfeld, who just finished a year ago. I forgot to say that the work on the leaf morphology was actually done in close collaboration with Hai Liang, who's now on the faculty at the University of Science and Technology in Hefei in China. Okay, so I want to start, actually, we're going to launch right in. I want to tell you about pollen tubes, and I want to use pollen tubes as an example where you cannot ignore the fact that new matter is being added, you can't ignore the fact that the whole thing is moving, and of course the real question that I want to try and address is that of what the form is. So, as I told you before, the pollen grain over here, the pollen grain of a lily, is of the order of about 20, 30, 50 microns in size, and can grow a pollen tube which can be very long, can be 100 microns, can be millimeters, some pollen grains can be actually centimeters long. And so what happens is that the pollen grain is transmitted by a bee, by wind, by water, I don't know what, comes to the pistil, which is the female organ of a flower, which I should have had a picture of, but you'll have to imagine just a long, slender stalk. And then, in response to humidity, in response to chemical cues from the ovule, it starts to grow a long tube. And so that's actually an interesting problem of, in this case, trying to navigate over a distance of centimeters and finding the ovule itself. So it can, as I said, be very long. This is a movie in real time of the growth of a pollen tube. What you see over here is the pollen tube pushing against actually a glass plate, a very soft glass plate. And what these experiments are showing, this is experiments done in Jacques Dumais' lab at Harvard, what these experiments were designed to show and actually measure the forces induced by the growth of this engine. So the pollen tube, as I said, can be a millimeter in size, can grow at microns per second, or fractions of microns per second, I should say, tens of microns per minute. And it can push against this glass plate and actually can do work. So it can actually penetrate. In fact, pollen tubes and fungal hyphae, which are analogs of them, except that they occur in fungi, can push the concrete. And people have seen this very slowly. It happens very slowly, so the forces are generated fairly slowly. What's the question? The question is trying to understand the shape. And I want to already indicate why this is an interesting sort of question. If I think of the pollen tube as a balloon-like material, so there's it's under fairly high pressure. People have measured the pressure, tens of atmospheres. And you know that if I introduce high pressure into a balloon, air at high pressure into a balloon, the balloon wants to swell and become spherical. So already an interesting question is, why is it not spherical? Why is it tubular? Right. Now, if I want to have something which is tubular and under pressure, I cannot have properties which are uniform in all directions. I must have properties in the azimuthal direction which are very different from properties in the longitudinal direction. In particular, it must be stiff in one direction and soft in the other direction. And in fact, you can actually see that that's consistent with the idea that I'm adding material primarily at the tip. Okay? So you see this vesicular transport. It's along the axis and towards the tip on the sides, and in the center, it's actually reversed. So you have actin, you have a whole bunch of railroads. I'm not going to get into the details. Fairly well understood, these railroad tracks along which you have motors, and the motors move vesicles. Inside the vesicles, you have the material which is added, and most of the material is added in the neighborhood of the tip. So you have new material being added at the tip. The tip is also soft. Because it's soft and new material is being added, it starts to essentially expand under the pressure. So if it starts to expand under the pressure, material starts at the tip and starts to move towards the equator, but simultaneously the tip is essentially being extended. So this is analogous to glass blowing. Okay? Except that in glass blowing, what you do is you apply pressure with your mouth, for example, or a set of bellows, and you change the properties of the glass by playing with temperature. And over here, instead of playing with temperature, you play with essentially the concentration of enzymes, which can either cross-link or gelate, make this, gel-like or fluid-like. So you switch the cell wall properties so that it becomes liquid-like or solid-like, and you do that primarily in the neighborhood of the tip. So I won't tell you about measuring force velocity curves, but in fact you can do that as well. So over here, what's been plotted is the maximum velocity of the tip relative to the maximum velocity that you can get as a function of the force, but that's a different story altogether. I want to try and address this question of how material is being added to the tip, how that added material causes flow to occur, and how this whole complicated machinery leads to a fairly simple shape, a tube, which is essentially translating at steady state. How do we combine the geometry to the transport and to the mechanics plus the chemistry? And I already told you what the process is. You have new material, uncrossing material, which is being brought to the tip. There's a high pressure inside relative to the outside called a turgor of the order of a few atmospheres. The material that's essentially brought to the tip, also in the vesicles with it, you have the uncross-linking enzyme. So pectin-methylesterases and pectin-methylesterase inhibitors. I don't want to get into the details, but it's very well understood how this cross-linking occurs through essentially the presence or absence of calcium. The pectin is essentially the same pectin that you see in your yogurt, which essentially allows the pectin to become gel-like. Okay. If you make yogurt at home, it's not as gelated as we buy pectin in a store, and that's because yogurt in the store has got a lot of pectin. So the same pectin is doing exactly the same thing that does to your yogurt, but over here in the cell wall. How can we make sense of this? And since this is a math colloquium, I'm not going to focus too much on the biology, I'm going to go directly to the model, but I'm going to tell you about what kinds of predictions the model has, and an interesting comparative question that in fact was already asked at least by Darcy Thompson. So I told you, we want to try and address the question of the shape, which means the size of the tube, the thickness of the wall, the speed of the tube. We'd like to look at the question of stability. We're just getting started. If you ask me questions at the end, I'll tell you what we know about it so far, but I really won't spend a lot of time on that. And you want to understand how all these parameters associated with the shape depend on the internal pressure that can be controlled. Even if you can't control the turgor inside, you can control the relative turgor by playing with the osmolarity outside. And you can do that by changing, for example, the concentration of sugar or ions outside. And again, these experiments have been done for nearly a century. Also, of course, you would expect that, in fact, the shape depends on what the wall is made of. pollen tubes and plant cells in general, as our fungal cells and bacterial cells, have cell walls, unlike animal cells, unlike the cells that we have. And these cell walls have the ability to withstand tremendous amounts of pressure, and they can flow. And they can flow as a consequence of the presence or absence of these cross-linking enzymes, which have wonderful names like expansins. Okay. And of course, you can't just worry about the mechanics, you also have to worry about how material is added. So you have to worry about the flux of matter to, in this case, the tip. What I gave you as an example of tip growth, a lot of plant cells also grow by adding material uniformly over their entire length. That's called diffuse growth. So this is a simple example of tip growth. I won't tell you about the load, the effects of external load. There are experiments ongoing. So if I think about this geometrically, and I think about this as a simple steady state problem, I have a tubular geometry, axisymmetric, symmetric, but with variations in the curvature in the longitudinal direction and in the azimuthal direction. So two components of curvature in the longitudinal direction, if theta is the angle, for example, that the tangent makes with, in this case, the axis of the tube, d theta ds is one curvature component, and sine theta over r is the other component of the curvature. I must have balance of forces, three components. The only two that matter, the third one is essentially trivially satisfied, the only two that matter are again in the azimuthal direction and in the axial direction. There's a third in the normal direction, but in the normal direction, the pressure is essentially exactly the normal stress. So these are essentially the two equations of motion. You might recognize this as a simple generalization of Laplace's law. Okay, so Laplace's law would tell us that the surface tension multiplied by the mean curvature is the pressure for a liquid interface. But this is not a simple bubble interface. It's actually a viscous liquid which can have stresses which are different in one direction compared to the other. And therefore, I have sigma SS in this direction different from sigma PP. Whether this, if they were the same, you would recover Laplace's law. And this is the equation for force balance in the longitudinal direction. So I have two equations over here combining the geometry and the stresses, but I have three unknowns. The three unknowns are the two components of the stress and one of the curvatures, which I can basically write in, and I can write the other one in terms of theta and r. So I need some closure relations, excuse me. And the closure relations require that I have to specify what the material is made of. So I'm going to now make an assumption. And the assumption is that the material is a simple viscous liquid, but with a viscosity which changes from the tip to the equator. Because I told you already, material is being added at the tip, and that material is essentially flowing, but by the time it comes to the equator, it starts to gelate and starts to behave more like a solid. Okay? So I'm going to make it an inhomogeneous, a liquid of inhomogeneous viscosity, viscosity changing from the tip to the equator, that's mu. And once I say that, and I also assume it's incompressible, then these two equations follow simply. And again, let me give you a simple physical feel for what each one of these terms means. That's essentially the velocity gradient, the rate of change of the velocity in the tangential direction. And this term, if I expand this out, d log r dt is 1 over r dr dt. And that's just telling you how the girth is changing per unit girth. So I have two contributions, because as I move the material from the tip down, I essentially extend it in the tangential direction, but I'm also changing the radius, and therefore I'm changing the amount of stress due to both these conditions. So I have sigma SS and sigma PC. And then finally, I have to have mass conservation, because I'm adding new material constantly, and I'm adding new material somewhere in the neighborhood of the tip. So there could be all of that material being added just at one location, or it could be more diffuse. But in either case, I have a mass balance equation, and that's my mass balance equation. The rate of change in material addition at the tip is associated with the flux, and then there is a source. And this gamma is related to J via this relation over here. So J is the total amount of material that I add. J is the integral of gamma times the area integral over that little strip that over which I'm adding the material. So that's my system, which is completely closed. There's my geometry, my force balance, my relation which relates the stresses to the strains, and mass balance. And what are my unknowns? Our unknowns are the velocity of the wall as the wall is being laid out and moving, the radius of the tube itself, and the thickness of the wall. So three unknowns, and I have enough equations over here. If I also now tell you the two key physical quantities that the plant cell can actually control, the pollen tube can control, the rheology of the wall material, how the viscosity changes, and the rate at which I'm adding material. So this seems, unfortunately, too much, because I have two whole functional forms which are unknown. So how do we essentially say something about it? Well, even though it's true that I have two complete functional forms, which means that I have an arbitrary number of parameters at my disposal, I know a little more. I know that I must have these equations, of course, asymptotically valid here, where the viscosity is very different, and asymptotically valid over there. So I'm going to look at what the asymptotics is in the tip, and what is the asymptotics in the tube, and I'm going to try and see whether that will allow us to constrain mu and j, and simplify things so the number of parameters becomes small, because otherwise it just becomes an exercise in curve fitting. Okay. So what's happening near the tip? I'll show you evidence for this in a minute, but for now there's very little reason to believe that all the material is being added just at one point. Okay. We know that in fact the material is being added primarily at one point, and we also know, because this is tip growth, that the material is not being added far away. Therefore, we expect there is some length scale over which the material is being added. Okay? So I'm going to say that that length scale, A, exists, and it's the transport length scale. And so with respect to that length scale, I can either plot in black, I plotted J. So at the tip, there's no area at all. So even if there's a finite amount of material that's being added, the area of which is being added goes to zero. And so J would go to zero. But it just increases at the tip as S squared, where S is essentially arc length, but also becomes radius near the tip. While if I think about gamma was the integral, the local rate of change of additional material, gamma goes to one in a scaled form at the tip, and no material is being added per unit area far away. J is just the integral of gamma. So gamma is finite over there and goes to zero. So that's gamma. They're equivalent. The black line is just an integrated form of gamma. It goes to zero at the tip and gives you a finite value far away, okay, according to this relation over here. All right, so all I need to basically now specify, which seems too much, but in fact I'm going to claim that the details of this function don't matter. All I need to specify is the value over there, either J naught or gamma naught, and then the length scale over which that's changing from the maximum value, most of the material is being added over there, less and less as I go further away, and then it goes to zero. So I have a functional form, but I know what its asymptotic behaviors are near the tip and far away. What about the rheology? Well, I already told you, and there is lots of evidence for the fact, that the liquid, that the cell wall is liquid-like near the tip, and it becomes solid-like far away. So I'm also going to now say mu, the viscosity, is a function of theta. And you might question this and say, well, it can't be a function of theta. It has to be a function of some local variable, such as the enzyme concentration. And I'm going to say, you're right, but in fact, I'm assuming that the viscosity of the wall, or the addition and removal of cross-linking enzymes, is fairly rapid compared to the rate at which I'm adding the material. And therefore, I'm going to replace the complex dynamics of how mu itself changes the function of concentration for simplicity over here by saying mu is a function of theta, where theta itself is a function, can be made dependent on the concentration. So mu at the wall is mu zero, so I've used that to scale, so that I get mu zero over mu's identity, and at the equator, far away, mu is going to infinity, because it essentially doesn't change its girth at all, and therefore, mu zero over mu goes to zero. Okay, so this is the asymptotic form for mu as a function of theta. It goes to zero, one over mu goes to zero far away from the tip, and it goes to some constant value, which is mu zero at the tip itself. And we've tried a whole bunch of different functional forms which respect this asymptotic behavior at the tip and at the tube, and it turns out that the results I'm going to show you don't seem to matter on that. All right, so these two unknown functional forms we are now freezing by basically freezing the asymptotic behavior at the tip and at the tube, both for mu and for either J, the flux, or the flux per unit area of gamma. And then we go back to the equation that I showed you and look for a steady state solution, which corresponds to this dynamical system over here. I'm going to simplify things even further, and I ask, can we essentially take this tip and tube asymptotics for the rheology and for the flux to characterize force balance and mass balance again at the tip and in the neighborhood of the tube. So let me just walk you through that quickly. So force balance says that the pressure, the turgor, which is essentially driving this, and again, there's 100 years of experiment which shows that by controlling the osmolarity of the environment, you can slow the growth. You can essentially cause it to stall. When you cause it to stall, the material is still being brought to the wall, and so what you see is the wall becomes thicker and thicker. Okay? When you switch off the turgor completely, the wall becomes thicker and thicker. On the other hand, you can reduce the amount of material being brought by playing with the machinery inside the cell. You can poison the actin, for example, and now if you keep the turgor constant, the pollen tube will burst because you're not able to essentially bring in material at the same rate that you require to form new cell walls. So there is an exquisite balance between the two. And in order to truly understand that, you have to understand the stability of the growth. But the problem is, that's not an easy question, because I don't know what I should keep constant. Am I keeping the pressure constant? Am I keeping the rate of material being added constant? So it's not clear stability to what kind of perturbation. Okay. And again, if anybody over here is a glass blower, you know this is a very, very basic question that you have to answer and ask over there. The first thing that you have to learn how to do in glass blowing is not to essentially either rupture or get a big blob. And that's because you have to play with the rate at which the rheology is changing, with the rate at which I'm blowing. Okay? Okay, so force balance over here is saying pressure acting over the tube radius, diameter is P times R squared, is balanced with the viscous flow. Okay? Mu times V over R, because the gradient is occurring over a characteristic scale R, multiplied by R times H, the thickness. So the R cancels out. That's my force balance equation. Mass balance I've already walked you through. And out of these two relations, you actually get a nice dimensional relation, which relates the tube radius to the viscosity at the tip, the flux at the tip, the turgor pressure, and the wall density. You can also do an asymptotic balance in the neighborhood of the tip. That was on the scale of the tube. This is an asymptotic balance in the neighborhood of the tip. I won't walk you through this. This is exactly the same kind of balance. A force balance and a mass balance essentially tells you what the tip radius is and what the velocity in the neighborhood of the tip is. And then you also have, so you get dimensional relations, scaling relationships for the tip velocity and the tip radius. You do not get a relationship for the tip thickness. That's because I'm using one length scale, and that what I'm using is the tip thickness itself to scale all the lengths in the problem. Okay, so that length scale essentially I can't pick up from this analysis. You need another mechanism. You need a microscopic mechanism, because what I've limited myself to talking about is only the meso and the macroscopic mechanism. So this is a question that I don't know an answer to, except if I start thinking very microscopically as well. And out of this tip and tube dimensionless or force and mass balance, we get out a dimensionless parameter, and that has a nice and simple interpretation, which I'll connect back to shape in a little bit. Alpha is the ratio of a transport length scale, A, the scale over which I'm adding material, to R0, which is a mechanical scale. R0 is associated with not just the transport, gamma zero, but also with the rheology and with the pressure driving the flow. And this dimensionless parameter, I'm going to claim, is sufficient to describe all the behavior that one sees experimentally in pollen and fungal tubes. Okay, so with that dimensionless parameter, and with these two balances that I told you about near the tip and far away from it, you get two scaling laws, one for the radius of the tube relative to the radius of the tip, in terms of the dimensional parameter alpha. R over R0 is alpha to the 2/3, and another one for the velocity of the tube relative to the velocity at the tip. V is the velocity of the tube, which is essentially the rate at which the pollen tube itself is growing. U0 is the rate at which the tip is expanding, also again as a function of alpha. And you can solve the equations and you can compare, and indeed you actually see good agreement with these simple scaling laws that you can derive more or less just by hand. Where do you go from here? Well, you want to compare real shapes. So what I want to now show you is the different shapes that you get as a function of alpha. So alpha, recall, was A over R0. Okay? This is a transport scale. And this is a tip radius. And I showed you that R over R0, which is the tube radius over the tip radius, goes as alpha to the power 2/3, a positive exponent. So as alpha becomes larger and larger, R over R0 becomes larger and larger, which means the shape should become pointier and pointier. Okay? And that's exactly what you see. As alpha becomes larger and larger, the shapes become pointier and pointier. And furthermore, there is also a relationship which tells you how V scales with alpha. And there's an old relation, qualitative relation, due to a guy called Reinhardt from the late 19th century, who said that in fact the shape of the pollen tube is actually correlated with the speed of the pollen tube. Okay? So this is actually giving you a qualitative, slightly more quantitative view of that. Can we compare with what you see in nature? Phycomyces is a fungus. Okay? Allomyces is another fungus. Aquila is related, it's not a fungus, it's an archaea. Saprolegnia and Borscheria are, again, fungi. Lily is a pollen tube. So very different molecular constituents, shapes which change, and the shapes change, the shape changes seem to be related to changes in alpha, or equivalently, changes in the rate at which material is being added at the tip compared to the tip length scale, which comes from a balance of forces and mass balance. So that suggests that maybe a way to classify these different shapes is simply by thinking about how this parameter alpha is changing. That's measurable. I want to show you a recent experiment from Peter Hepler's lab at UMass Amherst, where they're actually able to track, these are actin microfilaments, that is this actin fringe very close to the tip. You see in the neighborhood of the tip, in fact you should have seen in the videos as well, everything was very diffuse in the neighborhood of the tip. You didn't see a lot of structure, and that's because material is being added over there through vesicles, but you don't have the cytoskeleton at all. That scale, perhaps, is what we call A, the scale over which I'm adding material macroscopically, primarily at the tip, but not only at the tip, because it scales and reduces as I move further and further away. So A is something that's measurable, P is something that's not only measurable, but controllable, rho W is the wall density, measurable, mu zero is the tip viscosity, that's the hardest thing to measure. If we could measure that, it would be nice, but right now I don't know how to do that. Gamma zero, which is the rate of addition of material per unit area at the tip, also measurable, because you can just see how vesicle transport is arising over there. So with the exception of mu zero, you can measure all these parameters. It would be nice to be able to measure mu zero. If you can, you can start doing comparative morphology. What does that mean? I want to basically understand how alpha changes, and how, as alpha changes, does the tip shape change, and how does the speed change? That's where we are with this problem. So this is the first question that I wanted to raise. In simple physical theory, with two assumptions. One assumption is about the rheology, where you assume it's viscous, which is, of course, I'm sure, in detail, completely wrong, but it's a place to start. And the second assumption, which seemed crucial, is the presence of this macroscopic transport scale, which tells you on what length am I adding material. What we didn't do, what we haven't done, what we'd like to, is look at stability, because you need to actually exquisitely balance the rate at which I'm adding material with the rheology. Otherwise, the wall will thicken or the thing will explode. How does the plant control this is the basic question, which I don't think anybody really has a handle on. That's my first problem. So I'm happy to take questions at this point, or as you think about it, I want to jump to the second problem that I want to tell you about. So that's my first example. This is shape at this level of a single cell. And in simple-minded theory, not complete, but this is where we are. Stability is a time-dependent problem. No, I wrote down the time-dependent problem. I just didn't analyze the stability. And the reason I didn't analyze the stability is the question becomes stability to what types of perturbations, because I have a few control parameters that I have the ability to play with. I can play with the rheology, I can play with the pressure, I could play with the mass transport rate. So which of those parameters is important, we still don't know. I'll tell you a recent experiment that's again going on in Peter Hepler's lab, where what they do is they control the calcium concentration in the environment. And when they control that, instead of having steady growth, they essentially get pulsatile growth. Another kind of experiment that people have tried to do is sometimes with this cantilever, this obstacle that the pollen tube was pushing against, what they've done is to hold the cantilever against the pollen tube or the pollen for a finite amount of time and remove it. And when they do that, instead of continuously moving after you took the load off, it again starts to pulsate. So the question of stability first requires you to actually mathematically pose stability to what kinds of perturbations. And we've not made up our minds as to what the correct question is. But once we do, a fairly standard way, standard calculation one can do. We don't know what spaces we should be able to study this problem, yeah, experimentally. Mathematically, any number of possibilities, all of which are likely. Okay. My second problem is a problem on the scale not of a single cell, but of an entire organ. In this case, it could be a leaf, could be an algal blade. Okay, so kelp are large algae. And I got introduced to this problem by a colleague, Mimi Cole, at UC Berkeley, when I was in sabbatical there 3 years ago. And she showed me these pictures. So let me essentially walk you through these pictures. And these pictures are of a particular alga which grows off the west coast, near off the coast of Washington, Seattle. And these alga can actually show different shapes depending on the environment in which they actually are found. So this is a wonderful example of what the biologists would call phenotypic plasticity. Basically, you're seeing a macroscopic manifestation, in this case shape, which is a function of the environmental forces. So when these alga, which can be meters in length and a few tens of centimeters in width, when they are in slow flowing environments, their blades are fairly wide, but their edges are very ruffled. Okay? And what the biologists tell you is that that actually gives you an advantage. And it gives you an advantage, selective advantage over blades which are much narrower, because at slow flows, in slow flows, with ruffled edges, you can fluctuate. And if you can fluctuate, you can mix the environment around you. If you can mix the environment around you, you have good exchange of nutrients. Okay? Vascular, these algal blades are avascular, in that they don't have venous networks. So plants in terrestrial environments have veins which can essentially move water, they can move carbon dioxide, they can move nutrients around. In these underwater plants, often you don't essentially have the structure. The thickness of the leaf or the algal blade is a millimeter or two, diffusion sufficient to essentially move things through at the rate that is required. And if you have these ruffles, then you can also mix the environment. Okay? So that's what you see when you are in slowly flowing environments. What Mimi and others have done is they transplant these algal blades into rapidly flowing environments. And then within a generation, and in one season you can essentially see the whole thing happen, within a generation, new material which is being added gives rise to new blades, and these new blades are much narrower. Okay? And you can take these blades, and again, you can take the plant or the alga and then move it back. And the new material that's added will flip and give rise to morphologies which have wide ruffled edges. Okay? So why might you expect this to be of advantage in a rapidly flowing environment? Well, because in a rapidly flowing environment, because of the hydrodynamic forces, you're going to be flapping around anyway. And if I had wide ruffled blades, I get ripped off. So these guys would have descendants or wouldn't have descendants, right? While these guys would in those environments, because if I had these narrow fellows in the slow flowing environments, they're not fluttering around enough, may not be able to mix, can't grow fast enough, and so they'll overcome the ones with the narrow blades. That's the idea. So in order to test that, what Mimi did was to essentially punch holes in these algal blades and measure what happens to the distance between the holes in this environment and in that environment. So in rapid environments compared to rapidly flowing environments compared to slowly flowing environments. And she punched holes along the center of the blade and also punched holes along the edges of the blade and asked how far apart these holes moved relative to each other in slow flowing environments compared to rapid flowing environments. So this is what she's measured. What I'm showing you over here is the longitudinal strain rate, the rate at which these holes move apart as a function of the distance from the location where most of the growth is occurring, which is the bulbous region that I'm showing you over here. Far away, you don't have any growth. So this is like the pollen tube. Growth is localized to one region, and what you're reading out in space is essentially a sequence of how growth occurs in time. So this is a tape that's really being played out. And what they find, what she found, is that the edges shown over here in these white circles actually grow relative to the center line. So the edges actually have more material being added compared to the center line, and you immediately understand that if that's the case, then the edges must actually start to ripple because their perimeter is much larger. While over here, in these narrow blades, you don't see that difference, okay, up to error bars, and so there is no differential growth, and therefore they would remain flat. So this is growth, differential growth, and phenotypic plasticity driven by the environment, driven by external large-scale forces. Now, molecular biologists actually would like to go the other way. Now, they'd like to start with genetics. And so those experiments have also been done. So this is an experiment, example of an experiment that came out of Enrico Cohen's group at the John Innes Institute in Norwich. Wonderful title of the paper was The Genetic Control of Surface Curvature. Okay, so this is snapdragon. This is the leaf of the snapdragon, Antirrhinum. This is the normal leaf of the snapdragon. And these people were able to essentially mutate the leaf to actually give it a crinkly shape. And the mutation changes one thing. And that mutation, what it does is it changes the relative amount of cell proliferation. So the amount of new material that's being added. And it changes it as a function of location on the leaf. So this is the plant form of the leaf. This is the wild type. And you see in the wild type, it's more or less uniformly being added. So that's the front at which material is being added. And there's essentially very little difference. In fact, if there is a difference, the difference is that the edges are actually growing a little less than the interior. While in the syn mutant, the edges are growing much more. Okay, so the rate at which material is being added is much larger along the edges compared to the center. That's as if I was stretching the edges compared to the center. And then this whole thing, this flat leaf, becomes wrinkled. Just like what I showed you, but now in the previous example, driven by flow forces, but now in this case, bottom-up using genetics. Okay. So that would suggest that if I wanted to make a mathematical theory, first of all, I should really not worry too much about whether it's being driven top-down or bottom-up. I want to first ask, how can I essentially generate shape by having differential growth? So my pollen tube problem, the differential growth was really just adding material at the tip, and I'm giving you a tube. Now it's a little more complicated because I have a plant form. So in a few weeks, here and elsewhere, we will actually see leaves blooming and budding. And this is essentially a leaf from Hosta lancifolia, the plantain lily. Okay? And these leaves are, from this perspective, rather beautiful because they have an edge which is actually rippled. And furthermore, the entire surface seems to be saddle-shaped. Okay? Surface of negative gauss curvature. And so we want to understand what the mechanism is by which these shapes are generated, and so we did surgery. We, Hai Liang and myself, and of course when you do surgery on plants, nobody complains, so it's very nice. So we made little cuts parallel to the midrib, and when you make cuts parallel to the midrib, the first thing that you find is that was the original shape of the midrib before you took the lamina from either side away, and when you took the lamina from either side away, the midrib essentially straightened. So that suggests that in fact the midrib has the shape that it does because of the differential growth, because there is a certain amount of incompatibility. Mathematically, in fact, I'm going to tell you in a minute that I have a metric which I can't embed properly in Euclidean space, and that's essentially why I get these complicated shapes. While the little strips all started to flatten out as well. And it's because there was an incompatibility of the amount of growth that one strip was facing relative to the other, but when I essentially relieved that incompatibility and making cuts, they all were able to straighten out, relatively speaking. To check that that's true, we did the experiment with a piece of foam. That's a piece of foam. You stretch the edges a little bit, you get a saddle. You stretch the edges a lot compared to the center, you get ripples. Okay? So all of this suggests that unlike previously what I was telling you about how growth and form are related to each other by flow, over here is just elasticity. These are equilibrium shapes, and the elasticity is one that actually wants to actually minimize the elastic forces are determined by energy minimization, and so is the shape, and under the constraint of differential growth. The edges are growing more than the center. And there's a lot of work on these kinds of problems without worrying about the boundary conditions recently by Aaron Sharon, Areski Budaud, and so on. And our contribution over here has really been to actually carefully understand what happens in the neighborhood and the presence of real boundaries with the right boundary conditions. Okay, so I want to remind you very quickly of what we're trying to do now. So I'm switching now from these simple tubular structures to a sheet, which may not or may not be flat. So I need to understand its geometry, which I can completely characterize in terms of its curvatures, or in terms of the invariance, the mean and the Gauss curvature, which I don't have to emphasize here, but I must emphasize the fact that it's not a pure problem, it's not a problem in pure geometry, because I must think about the thickness. The thickness is finite, but not zero. And so I have deformations, which I'm going to assume are of a long wavelength character. So h, the thickness divided by l, the characteristic size is small, and also the curvature that you induce because of this differential growth is such that h times kappa is much less than 1. And I have to account for both in-plane stretching, so changing the metric, and also changing the curvature of the surface itself. Okay? So I could change the relative length of little elements compared to where they were, and I could also change the tangent-tangent correlation, which is essentially changing the curvature. And associated with each one of these modes of deformation, an in-plane mode and an out-of-plane mode, I have an energy. And the energy, if I'm thinking about the material, is being made of little springs, which are all harmonic, with a stiffness which is proportional to this quantity E, which is Young's modulus. If I integrate the energy across the thickness per unit area, I get 1 power of h, and the energy is proportional to the deformation squared, the strain squared, therefore it's proportional to gamma squared. While for the curvature-induced deformation, the strain, so if I have a thin sheet and I deform it, for example, into a cylinder, the top surface is stretched, the bottom is compressed. The amount of compression or stretching is proportional to the thickness multiplied by the curvature. And again, I think of this material as being made of little springs. Then the energy per unit area, I get 1 power of thickness because I integrate to the thickness, and I get 2 more powers because I take the square of the strain. So the energy per unit area due to bending is proportional to h cubed. So I have 1 power of h here, 3 powers of h here, and if h goes to 0 compared to L, which is the limit I am in, this is always a cheap mode. This is an easy way of deforming. This is an expensive way of deforming. And so the sheet always likes to bend and would not like to stretch, except it's really forced to through incompatibility. And what is that incompatibility? That incompatibility comes through the fact that Gauss taught us a long time ago, comes through the intrinsic curvature of the surface. I cannot flatten a part of a sphere. I can't take a flat sheet and cover a sphere smoothly. And so it's that incompatibility that prevents you from essentially giving simple decoupled deformations which are purely due to stretching or purely due to bending. They will essentially strongly couple. And that's why you get all this complexity of shape in thin films, not just in biology, but elsewhere. So how do I characterize that? So I want to first tell you about a simple simulation that got us thinking about it, and then I will tell you very briefly about a calculation. I don't have much time. So the simulation is literally taking what I told you and using it to build a computer code. So I think of my leaf as being made of a bunch of springs, this triangular lattice over here, with harmonic potentials associated with any two neighboring nodes. I have a stretching energy associated with pulling those nodes apart relative to a natural length. That's my stretching strain squared, summed over all possible nodes with a modulus S. And I also have an energy associated with taking two adjacent triangles and turning their normals away from each other. So that's a bending contribution. Okay? So then I also sum over all possible neighboring triangular surfaces, triangular plaquettes, and I penalize the energy by basically asking how far apart their normals are. And the key parameter that we'd like to change is the rest length of the springs, because that's growth. I'm adding new material, relatively speaking, at one location compared to the center. And so you can use the conjugate gradient method, you can do molecular dynamics, you can do what you want. But once I have that energy, I can go to town. And you can get, for example, the shape that I told you. Okay? Not only can you do that, you can actually get a phase diagram. And that's the important and interesting thing, I think, if I want to do comparative study. I told you about what Darwin said, you know, there's this incredible complexity. Can I reduce that complexity to some kind of phase diagram for the shapes? So here is an attempt to do that. What are the two parameters? I'm thinking about long leaves. If I had short leaves, I have one more parameter, which is three-dimensional. If I have long leaves, I have only one dimensionless parameter, which is the width relative to the thickness. That's this axis over here, a logarithmic scale. And on this axis, I've plotted the edge strain. Okay, so I could have a gradient in strain going from the maximum to zero at the center. That would introduce one more scale. I'm showing you again a snapshot through this much more complicated phase diagram. So over here, we're saying that all the strain is localized to the edge. Okay? And so the strain is a length per unit length, so it has no dimensions, and that's now being varied over the magnitude. And so with the numerics, you can pick up this phase diagram. Small amount of strain or very narrow width, it remains flat. No surprises there. You cross a boundary whose form satisfies the simple scaling law. W over H is beta, the edge strain to the power minus half. I'll tell you how that comes about in a minute. You cross that, you first switch to a catenoid-like shape. You cross a second boundary, and these simulations, because they're simulations, have been done with finite length. You can't essentially have an infinite length ribbon. So there's a second boundary, and that second boundary, when you cross, you go from a catenoid-like shape to a shape which has edge ripples. If the length of the ribbon becomes longer and longer, these two scaling laws essentially are undifferentiated. You cannot differentiate them. These two lines essentially fall on top of each other. And so you can have coexistence of saddles with ripples on the edge. Okay. So what's the question that remains? So we have this phase diagram, and if you were a botanist, you can do zoology with this, if you know what I mean. You basically can take every leaf that you think about, and then you ask, well, where does this sit? And how is the leaf essentially controlling either W or beta? And that can be a response either to molecular mechanisms, which are genetic associated with these thin mutants which change cell proliferation, or you can essentially have macroscopic forces. Okay, so one view of morphology of leaves is movement in this phase space as a function of molecular or macroscopic variables. Not been done yet. You can do a little more using scaling. I am running out of time, so I'm not going to tell you too much, except to point out a couple of things. So the catenoid, of course, is a very famous surface in mathematics and differential geometry because it's a minimal surface. And in fact, you know that there are these beautiful conformal transformations which allow you to which take you from a catenoid to helicoid and back. But here you're seeing the catenoid not as a minimal surface, but a Willmore surface. Okay, so Willmore surfaces are generalizations of minimal surfaces where instead of minimizing the area integral, I'm minimizing the mean curvature squared over the entire area. So over here, I'm starting to see Willmore surfaces intersect catenoids. And why do you get them? Why do you get a catenoid? Well, it's very easy to see just from this picture over here. So if the edge has a longer length than the center, and if I wanted to deform, if I wanted to accommodate the deformation, well, if I push the edge into a circle, then the diameter of that circle, the circumference of the circle, must be larger than that of the center. And you know a catenoid essentially does that beautifully for you. Because the center line has actually a shorter circumference than the two edges. And immediately, you essentially must get a surface of negative Gauss curvature. So naturally, as soon as you have these edges growing relative to the center, you'll get surfaces of negative Gauss curvature, and out of that, you also get, by actually minimizing the energy, you get this relation which I showed you, which you can actually get numerically as well, which is that the critical strain at which you get instability is proportional to the aspect ratio squared. And so W over H goes as beta to the minus 1/2, which is exactly what I showed you, you get numerically. A second part of this is what happens when you have much larger strains. Why do you get edge ripples? And a way to understand that, at least physically, mathematically you can do it as well, but physically is also, I think, interesting. I ask the question, if I take a sheet like this, and I introduce a pinch at the end, how far into the sheet will I feel the pinch? And that's a non-trivial question, because once I have a pinch in one direction, I've introduced curvature in one direction. If I wanted to be flat far away, and I expect that because the sheet is very, very long, there's no reason why that pinch will propagate. Now that pinch will essentially generate a surface of non-zero Gauss curvature because it's curved in one direction, but also must be curved in the other direction. If that pinch persistence was too long, then the energy is going to go up. If it was too short, the energy will also go up because the Gauss curvature is very tightly concentrated. So in either limit, it's bad news. So somewhere in between, you actually get a characteristic scale. And I got to ask, what is that characteristic scale, which is an intrinsic scale, compared to the width of the leaf? When the width of the leaf is small compared to that scale, the leaf is almost flat, or it forms buckles, sinusoidal buckles, which have very little variation in this direction, but are periodic in that direction. On intermediate scales, which means when this pinch persistence length, which I've written out over here, in terms of the amplitude of the pinch, the wavelength of the pinch, or the inverse of that, the wave number, and the thickness, when that scale is comparable to W, it's curved this way, and it's also curved that way. And when you essentially have this pinch persistence length small compared to the width, most of the ripples, all the ripples are essentially localized to the edge itself. There's very little in the interior. And you can see examples of all these if you walk out and look at long leaves. Okay? All right. You can do it in a little even more sophisticated way by writing down partial differential equations and looking at the asymptotics. And I won't tell you about that except to point out that these equations are equations which you actually naturally see in differential geometry as well, but now asking, in addition to satisfying some geometric constraints associated with growth, which gives you a metric which is no longer delta ij. Okay? How now do I introduce physics into the problem? Well, I also say that in addition to this prescribed metric, I want to minimize the energy, and the energy has contributions associated with changes in the metric relative to the original metric, and changes in the second fundamental form which are associated with changes in the curvature. Okay, so I have two contributions, one from an in-plane and one from an out-of-plane contribution, and I get two hyper-elliptic equations which are actually, which have quadratic nonlinearity associated with this bracket, which is not a Poisson bracket, okay, so it's just notation convenient. But I'm not going to get into the details of this because I'm running out of time, and I want to actually tell you about the third problem. Oh, well, one thing that I can't resist, again, because I'm here in the Fields Institute, is that there are a lot of other examples of growing surfaces, and there's a beautiful question which would be fantastic to address that it hasn't been addressed yet. We know for more than 100 years, thanks to Hilbert and Poincaré, that you cannot embed the hyperbolic plane, a surface of constant negative Gauss curvature, in R3. You're going to get self-intersection. It's well known. Okay, and there are all kinds of models for that. But I'm now asking a physical question. I'm asking, well, even if you can't do that with the complete hyperbolic plane, can I do it for a patch? Because patches of hyperbolic planes you see all over the place. You see them, if you look at plants, you look at leaves, you look at flowers, you look at the beautiful kinds of patterns that people who blow glass can give you. Lanterns with all these frills at the edges. And here is an example of that. This is my favorite example. It's actually been crocheted by a mathematician, Dinah Taimina. She builds these crochet models. In fact, this was a challenge posed by Bill Thurston, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, is can you visualize a patch of the hyperbolic plane? And in response to that, she started to essentially build these models. And we've started to get into this slowly using numerics. Okay, so how can you essentially minimize the energy of a surface of constant negative Gauss curvature, and the energy is now an energy associated with what I told you before, with changing the in-plane metric and the out-of-plane metric. That's a question, I don't have an answer. So I have run out of time, I think, but maybe I have 5 minutes? Okay. So I want to tell you about a third problem, which is associated with how you can, can you understand the basic structure of the folding of the brain? Right. So what is the basic structure of the folding of the fold of a brain fold? Well, the basic structure is something that you can see if you bend over and you see your fat stomach essentially trying to intersect itself, and it can't intersect itself, so it essentially self-contacts. Okay, so it's a crease. That's what locally a crease looks like. This is a piece of foam on which basically you impose this strong deformation, which you can see over here. It looks like elephant hide. Some part of the surface has contacted some other part of the surface over here, and then, even more complicated, that crease has essentially formed one kink over there and a second kink over there, and it's left. That's in foam. This is a swollen gel. It's a swollen gel which has essentially been stuck to a rigid substrate. So you have, you could use yogurt, for example, or you could take a dough or some gel, stick it to a substrate, and then squeeze, or let the gel swell. If you let the gel swell, at the bottom, it cannot swell in this direction because it's stuck to the substrate. It can easily swell in the normal direction. At the top, it can swell in the vertical direction, but because of the constraint at the bottom, it can't swell horizontally. So you have very large compressive stresses. And in response to the compressive stresses, you get these patterns. And over here, you can clearly see most of the swelling has occurred in that direction.
Okay.
This is a cross-section through a primate brain, trying to look at the folded cortex. So this is essentially what is called sulcus, so the crease. And again, you see, okay, it's a little more complicated over here because you have different properties, different types of matter, gray matter and white matter and the neocortex and so on and so forth. But nevertheless, you again see this very strongly localized structure. And here is a pedestrian experiment that was done by Evan Holfeld as he was doing his PhD, where he took a piece of gel, PDMS in this case, polydimethyl siloxane, a rubber, and then he deformed it into a horseshoe. And when he deformed it into a horseshoe strongly enough, he found that at the location of maximum curvature, you formed a crease. Okay? That's a simulation. This is what is residual strain after you've opened it out. So why is this interesting? many reasons. I think of this as an anti-crack, because in a crack you're opening up new interface. Here you're losing interface. Okay? A crack is a topological instability because you're fundamentally changing the topology of the body by essentially introducing new interfaces. This is also therefore a topological instability because I'm losing it. A crack microscopically gets a length scale because of the balance between surface energies and bulk energies. If I didn't have a surface energy, as in these gels sometimes you don't, or you're very, very small, then you don't have a length scale. Okay, you don't have a length scale in classical elasticity. You don't have a length scale in the boundaries, I'm thinking about large domains. So there is no length scale unless there's one associated with the interface energy compared to the bulk energy. And if I take that length to go to zero, then it seems like there is no length scale at all. That's the question that we would wanted to try and address. Can we ask the question of what happens to instabilities as the length scale starts to go to zero? Okay, you can ask this question mathematically. Experimentally, it's a little harder, but let me ask the question mathematically first. I'm going to ask it by essentially reminding people, if you know about this, and if you don't, of work by Bio, and this Bio is different from the Bio of Bio Sava in vortex dynamics. This is a much more recent Bio. And he asked the following question. He asked, what would happen, and I'll stop by just describing this and telling you the result. What would happen if I compress a half space, so a free boundary, at plus or minus infinity? So I apply stresses at plus or minus infinity, constant stresses. What would happen? So no length scale in the problem, no length scale in the equations of equilibrium. Therefore, if anything happened, it should happen with an instability which has no length scale. So the only possibilities are, without a calculation, either the wavelength that's unstable is lambda equals infinity, which means that I just translate the interface and so there's no instability, or lambda equal to zero, which of course is a disaster. Of course, mathematically it's beautiful because it says that I have a singularity at infinity, an infinite wave number in instability. So the only conclusion that you can draw, which is the conclusion that he drew, but then I also calculated, was that the instability that arises must be one with an infinite wave number, zero wavelength. In addition, he did a dynamical calculation and he showed that in fact, past the critical stress, all wavelengths are unstable, but the one that's most unstable is the one with an infinite wave number. Okay. So where does that leave you? Nowhere. Right? It simply says that I have to either introduce a length scale, or I have to essentially follow the instability into the nonlinear regime to see what happens. Okay. And he couldn't do that because this was 40, 50 years ago. You can't do this. You can't do this except numerically. It's just impossible. This is a problem which has multiple invariances in it. It has scale invariance, because there's no scale. It also has translation invariance, because I don't know once the instability arose, where it would arise. Okay? So with Evan, we decided to break all these symmetries one by one. So we broke the scale invariance instability by introducing a thickness of a skin. So you first stick a skin down to the substrate, because like our skin. Then you take, mathematically, the limit of the skin thickness going to zero. But that still leaves you the translation invariance, because I don't know where the instability will arise. So I've broken scale invariance by introducing a length scale. I've not broken translation invariance. In order to break translation invariance, you take the horseshoe. Now I know that it's only one location where I get a maximum curvature, and so I've broken translation invariance as well. And now we're going to take, mathematically, the limit of making the thickness go to zero and calculating numerically what happens to the shape as a function of the thickness going to zero. So I said you break translation invariance, you break scale invariance, and then you calculate the bifurcation diagram. Bifurcation diagram for what? The bifurcation diagram for the formation of the crease. And that was done using a finite element method, using a geometric grid, because of course it's very, very tricky how you regularize the problem there, and you want to make sure that the skin thickness is small, large compared to the mesh size. So you have to have smaller and smaller elements. So Evan implemented that. And then, in order to actually look at the solution, not only of the stable solution, but also the unstable solution, use homotopy. Numerically implement homotopy to essentially track the unstable solution as well, for a very simple model of the material, which is what's called the Neo-Hookean model, just a piece of rubber. And here's the result. And this leaves me with a puzzle, with all of us, I think, with a puzzle, and maybe somebody over here can help answer that. So here is the thickness of that horseshoe at the location where you expect the crease to form as a function of the deformation that they induce from either side, so you're squeezing it. Okay? For a finite value of the skin thickness, you actually get the thickness decreasing, and then, actually not drawn very well over here, decreases, it does that. Okay? So what happens is that when it forms this, so this is h, the height as a function of the displacement of the ends. So what's happening over there is that the free surface looks like this. Okay? So it forms this. Okay? So the shape is like an inverted omega. But as I reduce the thickness, first thing that happens is that this develops an infinite slope, and then it turns on itself. Okay? So it's a classic hysteresis. So you say no surprises over there, that's what I'd expect, because the thing will essentially form an inverted omega. The real surprise is that as I reduce the thickness even further, this hysteretic picture that I showed you, that's unstable, this is stabilized by contact, because two parts of the material touch each other. This unstable branch goes further and further towards the stable branch, but this point stays where it is, and this point moves towards the stable branch, and so the final limit is that the S becomes a T. Okay? And there is, in fact, an unstable branch, which of course nobody could have known unless you computed it numerically, right below the stable branch, not in the neighborhood of a point. I have an entire manifold of them. So I have a second critical stress, which Bior could not have suspected, which nobody could have suspected unless you did a numerical calculation. And I want to tell you what that means, but I don't know how to actually formulate the complete mathematical problem. We have some ideas. I'm done. So, may I just finish with two statements? So, elasticity, continuum mechanics, doesn't have topology built in, doesn't have non-local information. Partial differential equations don't have non-local information built in about topology or interfaces and so on. You've got to put that in by hand. Contact is a fundamental question, which in fact there is no picture of. Breaking of interfaces, no picture of. Bringing interfaces together, no picture of. Contact, there's no picture of. So in elasticity, you never know, in these free surface problems, you never know when one part of the surface will touch another. With one exception. And that one exception one might think is pathological, but it isn't. And that one exception is when two points which are infinitesimally close to each other touch each other. And you think that's completely pathological because it's very unlikely. But that's exactly what's happening over here. Because on the way, when the instability occurs, you fall off the cliff and you form a crease of finite size. But when you open it out smoothly. And if you open it out perfectly smoothly, you get what I'll call perfect hysteresis. So that when the last two points leave each other, those are the last two points which are in contact. And that's this location right there. And there's no reason why that can't happen. It's not a mathematical artifact at all. It's real. It's robust. That's what's happening. So this S becomes a T, and it says that I have to rethink what's going on, and that's an infinite wave number instability if I hadn't introduced the length scale. So I have to rethink this, and I'll stop with that because I know I've run well over time. So you can compare the numerics with the experiments. I'll let you mull over this as I stop. So thank you very much.